Everyone, welcome to the Dreamer's Edge podcast.
With Nicholas, I'm the gaming correspondent for Idiomatic.
And I am Dimitri, editor-in-chief of Idiomatic and movie critic. In anticipation of the new Star Trek movies coming out, Paramount has released a whole bunch of Star Trek DVDs. All the movies are out again. The TV series. They're restocking the shelves with Star Trek.
Yeah.
And we thought it would be a good occasion for us to survey the Star Trek universe. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about all of the movies with the original crew in this episode. And then in our next episode, talk about the Next Generation.
Sounds good.
Yes. Now, for this episode, though, we are going to skip Star Trek The Motion Picture because we already talked about it at length in our previous episode, Worst of the 80s.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about it again in our upcoming Don't F with the Original
I know
episode. So we're going to skip right to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
The best one ever. Khan, the character that was established in one episode of the original series, and he basically gets stranded on the planet as punishment for trying to take the Enterprise, and he basically gets off the planet and wants revenge on Kirk.
This time, it's personal.
It is. Very good movie. Probably one of the best in the series. And one of the best of all the movies, honestly. My favorite. Great acting by the bad guy, Ricardo Montalban.
Oh, he's terrific.
Spectacular. There's not much else to say. It's a very good movie. You know, and again, it still has the message of, you know, hope and, you know, things can go better if you work hard enough for it.
Even though that one has a pretty heavy sacrifice to get to that betterness.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there's this whole thing about Kirk never having faced the no-win scenario, and he's faced with it at the end, and, you know, he can kind of see him react to it. Good stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, that's a movie that actually, yeah, now that you mention it, introduces the Kobayashi Maru challenge, which is something that every member of the Starfleet Academy, except Spock apparently,
yeah,
had to take, and where they have to face the no-win scenario, and Kirk somehow, they never explain how.
Yeah. Oh, they do. They do explain how.
Well, later.
Later, but yeah, it's basically a plot point where one of the characters that just took the test, she keeps asking, how did you beat it? How did you beat it? And Kirk, he's just the smuggler, I'm not telling you.
But they don't go into the details of it until the reboot of because he says what he did, but it's very cryptic and vague. It communicates what you need to know to understand who Kirk is, but it doesn't really communicate how it is you do that.
Exactly.
And I want to spoil it because, you know, it's a 30-year-old movie at this point. His answer is that he cheated.
Yeah.
And what it communicates about Kirk is what Star Trek has communicated to people for years, is that you should not let anything stop you when you want to achieve greatness.
Yeah.
And that's because when Kirk says he cheated, what he's saying is, I didn't let the rules bog me down.
Exactly. He didn't believe in, like, the no-win scenario. So, you know, I didn't believe in that. So, you know, I made it work.
Yeah, exactly. And that's optimism. That's what it is. That's that sense of, like, I will achieve greatness no matter what.
Yeah.
And the nice twist in there is that he still ends up having to deal with a no-win scenario where to achieve greatness, he's got to lose something. And the cost is very big.
Yeah.
We'll have to spoil it because we're going to talk about Star Trek 3. So I might as well. He loses Spock.
Yeah. Spock basically sacrificed himself to save the ship. Mm. And, you know, you see Kirk, he's... You know, for Shatner, that was very good acting on his part.
Yeah, it's a great human moment of, like, Kirk the great and powerful who will let nothing stop him. Just go like, oh no, you're going to pay like everyone else, buddy. You want greatness, it comes at a price.
Exactly.
It's a beautiful moment. That's why it's so powerful, because it resonates not just in terms of how the characters feel about each other, but also how we feel about life. We want to have everything, but we don't really want to pay for it. And this movie sort of is like, no, you're going to pay for it. Like, that's how life works.
Exactly.
And I like that they set up a new Vulcan to replace Spock to sort of give that sense of continuity where it's not like, oh, and then they lose Spock and the story will be sad forever. No, there's this sort of newness. Life goes on. You have this Kirstie Alley character who was, I think, the only Vulcan in all of Star Trek history, apart from Spock, obviously, to actually get it right in terms of her acting.
I don't know. I think Tuvok had it good on Voyager, but nobody watched Voyager. But, you know, did the no emotion things, he had it down pat.
He did, but there was a sort of gravity to the way he was performing it. It was always very somber.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I can't imagine the Vulcan race being always so damn somber and almost sinister the way that Tuvok plays it.
I guess.
Whereas Kirstie Alley manages to capture that we have no sense of humor vibe while still maintaining that lightness in her character. And I think that's the secret that I think Tuvok misses a bit.
But it's not that Vulcans don't have emotions, that they control them. So that, I guess that, you know, Tuvok is trying to, you know, it's probably pretty hard for him and the others have the galaxy to control everything. So I liked his performance in Voyager, honestly. But you're right, her performance is very good in that one too. Mm. Shame she didn't come back for the sequel.
I know. What was that all about? Because I was like, yeah, that new girl, she's going to be cool. I'm looking forward to her. Change the actress and give her like this semi-sexist motherly role.
Yeah, exactly. I guess she was busy in Cheers or something. I don't know.
Maybe she read the screenplay and was like, yeah, that's not what I signed on for. Exactly. Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, because Search for Spock is terrible.
Yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. Basically, they realize that, you know, Spock is still, you know, his memories are still in McCoy. And so, you know, if he can find the body, he can come back, basically.
Yeah, because he's in McCoy because he did a little mind meld thingy before he died.
Exactly. And it's basically them searching for, you know, Spock's body to bring him back. And they meet Klingons along the way that they're interested in Genesis and what happened. You know, Genesis from the first movie, basically creating life out of nothing. And Klingons are interested in that as a weapon. It's very weak.
It's a necessary evil in the sense of you got to get Spock back. Yeah. Especially since you've lost Kirstie Alley.
Exactly.
And how do you get to that? Well, you got to make it the whole story. Otherwise, it'll diminish the impact of Wrath of Khan. Like, his death has to mean something. And for his death to mean something, if he's going to come back, you have to spend the entire movie about it so that it feels like you've worked towards getting him back instead of, like, in the first act, Spock shows up like, yeah, I got better. Like, you know.
Hey, it works for X-Men. Why not just, you know?
But but that's the problem with X-Men. Yeah. It devalues the drama of their death as a result.
You're right.
So I appreciate that they made the whole story, the search for Spock, in an effort to make Wrath of Khan still stand after all these years. But it does mean that they tanked a movie to do it. And that's sort of a weird choice when you think about it. I mean, like, I'm sure they thought it would work out, but it didn't.
It did kind of had a nice message to it. All, you know, like at the end of the second one where, the, you know, Spock sacrificed himself, you know, he's like, why did you do it? And it's like, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And when, you know, pretty much everybody sacrifices their careers and, you know, pretty much maybe their freedom to go and save Spock. And he's like, why did you do all this? And it's like, well, the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many. They care for Spock. So, you know, it doesn't matter. You did it for us. We'll do it for you.
Yeah, it's sort of like the Three Musketeers, one for all and all for one, essentially. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, no, you're right. It was actually a touching moment, and there's that beautiful moment where Spock essentially is reborn on a planet called Genesis, where his corpse landed, and for some reason the soil gave birth to a new Spock. I'm not entirely sure how the logic of that works, but that's what happens. When you plant a Vulcan, the same Vulcan grows from the ground.
Exactly.
Vulcans are farm. Nobody knows that. But there you go. You heard it here first.
He grows up and looks exactly the same as, you know, not his appearance not being altered by, you know, his experience in life or whatever. No,
he has the same scars. It's weird.
Yeah, exactly.
That scar that Leonard Nimoy got when he was playing in Mission Impossible. He got it on the Genesis planet, too.
Nice.
But I love the final line. He says, like, you were always my friend or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like a super touching line. It works.
Yeah.
But having said that, oh my god, what a load of nonsense.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even remember everything with the Klingon, because this is a movie I avoid, you know. I still feel, you know, even though, yeah, you're explaining you have to take the whole movie to get, you know, Spock back, or else it kind of, you know, taints Wrath of Khan. It still taints Wrath of Khan for me, even though. So I was like, I saw it once, maybe twice, and it's like, no, I do not recommend it for anybody. Basically, they got Spock back. Just, you know, it took 2 hours and they got Spock back.
For me, Search for Spock makes the same sin that motion picture does, in that it's really freaking boring.
Yeah.
Like, it's 2 hours of, like, I don't care.
That's true. Yeah.
moving on, then, to an even-numbered one, which means that people must like it. And yeah. I'm actually in the exception here. I don't like that movie.
Yeah.
It's Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Yes. Where they basically have to find humpback whales to save the Earth, because there's this entity that used to apparently communicated with humpback whales on Earth. And now they're extinct, so it doesn't get the message. So it's came to see what's happening, and it's causing, like, evaporating all the water on Earth and causing major, you know, problems. So, you know, they have to go back in time and get some whales in the 20th century.
Yeah, like, why in the 20th century, where, like, Greenpeace is trying to protect them and because they're becoming... It's like, why not earlier when there were more of them?
I guess time travel is a tricky thing. So, I mean, they explain that it's not an accurate science. They don't know exactly where they're going to, you know... So they just happened to, you know, land exactly when, you know, at their time, you know.
I guess, and they shouldn't want to take the whale that the alien first communicated with, otherwise there wouldn't be the communication in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense to me mm-hmm. is the scene where they discover it's whales, where it's like, what's that sound? It was like, add some gerbil to it. Yeah, some echo to it. It's a whale. And I'm like, yeah. How did you know that? Like, really, like, do you listen to random animals outside of water in your pastime and go like, well, maybe it'll come up?
Actually, they do. They kind of say, you know, they listen to the signal and it's like, well, the signal is in at the ocean. That's why they're evaporating it. They're like, what would the signal sound underwater? And they listen. It's like, oh, those are humpback whales. You know,
yeah, but how do you know that it's a humpback whale?
I know it's extinct. So, you know, maybe there's somebody very, very very smart. I forgot who it is that's like, oh, it's a humpback whale.
Like, you know? You know what? I think the scene would have almost worked better if, like, Scotty would have been like, really? Sounds like a seahorse to me. Yeah. He's like, no, it's a humpback whale. Seahorse. No, Scotty. Humpback whale.
The movie is a product of its time, as in, you know, fish out of water type movie.
That's funny.
That's, yeah. Whales are mammals. That's not kind of a joke. Come on. A joke doesn't work at all. Mammal out of water. But basically, like, they have, you know, Beastmaster going into modern time or, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, it's the Greenpeace fave of, like, oh, the whale.
Yes. And, you know, it was funny. Basically seeing those people from the future that you think you know history, but they're completely lost in modern society. It's like, exact change only. What does that mean? They're trying to take the bus and Spock trying to curse, or a Russian asking for nuclear vessels. It is, you know, pretty much a product of the 80s, and it is funny for that. And yeah, people love it.
Yeah, people really do. Like, that is a lot of people's second favorite. Everybody loves Wrath of Khan first.
Yeah.
But the second favorite is often... Voyage Home. For me, it's actually Undiscovered Country, but we'll get to that later.
And it is the one actually that made, you know, by Corrective Reflection, the most money.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Oh. So people really loved it. I guess because it was accessible, you know. It's basically, you didn't have to know the characters or the backstory. They're just people from the future coming to modern Earth. What the hell happens here?
I think that's what I don't like about it, actually. For me, it's sort of like, well, that's not Star Trek. Wait, yes, granted, most Star Trek episodes were time travel, but
yeah.
To an era strangely close to our own.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like, it's a fish out of water comedy, and it's Back to the Future, except the twist is that Spock and Kirk and Bones are in it. It's like, that's not a twist for Star Trek. That feels more like a ripoff. It feels more like a randomly generated screenplay, and they're like, what franchise could we connect to this, you know?
I guess, yeah.
I mean, I know that's not how it was created. I know Trekkers and Trekkies will be quick to write it. It's like, well, Leonard Nimoy actually wrote it. Like, I understand that, but it feels like a randomly generated screenplay.
Yeah. I can see that, but, you know, the main thing about the movie to me is it enjoyable? And yeah, this was, stuff happened. It was funny, you know, there was humor.
Okay. The jokes were funny.
Yeah. And so it's an enjoyable watch, you know. Is it the summum of sci-fi? No, it's not. They're getting whales from the past and bringing back to the future. You know, forget the point that, you know, two whales will not repopulate the Earth of whales, you know. It's not going to work.
That's a good point.
I guess they can clone them or something since they're in the future.
They can replicate them.
Yeah, I guess. You can't replicate living stuff like that. Come on.
And plus, it's not even the right generation.
But, you know, it's fun. That's all it is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. For me, I feel Star Trek movies should always sort of speak to that optimism about going for it and all of that. And
yeah.
Star Trek 2 and 3 do that in different ways. And Star Trek 4 is just sort of like, here's some kooky stuff. You know, it's very shallow.
The message is simple. You can send stuff to extinction and just go back to the past and get some new stuff.
And he takes a Earth woman with her, too. He's like, hey, you can raise whales with me in the future.
She wants to come because she hates the modern time. You know, she felt betrayed because they got rid of the whales without her, you know, and she loves those whales. So she has to come back to the future to take care of her whales.
Yeah, well, she's a little bit selfish in regard to her family there, but...
That's a good point. Maybe she had no family. Let's just assume that.
Maybe she's an orphan. It'll be a cheerier story if she is.
Yeah, she's an orphan without a husband or kids.
I find it's a pretty cynical movie in the sense of it's very like, oh, well, here's what we're doing wrong, and the future will have to fix it, and we can through time travel, but we're doing all of this wrong, we're bastards. And it's sort of like, it's not Star Trek. That's not what I want to see from Star Trek.
That's a good point. Hmm.
But, okay, I realize I'm in the minority here, and, boy, if you're already starting to shake your fist at me, wait till you hear what I have to say about Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
Yes.
Which I believe, now, I haven't quite verified everywhere yet to make that assertion for sure, but I am about 98% sure that I am the only person on Earth to like this movie.
Probably. Yeah.
I'll let you tell the story, though, just because it'll be funnier if it comes from somebody who hates it.
It's basically they're looking for God at the center of the galaxy.
Yeah, there's Spock's never mentioned before half-brother who shows up, and he's like all emotions and stuff. Like, he's a cult leader, essentially, is what he
pretty
is.
Much. He toys with people's emotion. He's not emotion, but basically he makes people's hurt go away by talking to them, and I don't know.
But like, he's not a Vulcan in any traditional sense.
No.
And he's like all this jovial people who gets people in his cult, and he wants to find God in the center of the universe.
Yeah.
And he hijacks the Enterprise to do it.
Exactly.
And that's the basic premise of the movie. And I know already a lot of people, like a lot of sci-fi fans, hate when you throw in God into that stuff.
Yeah.
And I understand it. It's sort of the same thing as how I feel about Crystal Skulls with the Indiana Jones. It's not a question of hating God or anything.
Yeah.
It's a question of it belongs in one part of fiction or it doesn't. Like, yes, I understand that aliens are just as likely as the Ark of the Covenant. But Indiana Jones deals with mystical threats, not sci-fi threats.
Exactly.
And Star Trek deals with sci-fi concepts, not spiritual ones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, minor spoiler, it turns out it's not God. It's even worse.
Actually, no, I like that ending a lot. Which is probably why I'm the only person that likes the movie. But I feel that a lot of people have different interpretations of what happens in the end. So I'll let you go first. What is it that, according to you, happens?
Isn't God actually the manifestation of that guy who was looking for his ego? And I mean, wow, that makes absolutely no sense. It's just weird. It's like, how did his ego manifest itself on that particular planet exactly? Why?
It's the sheer power of his hubris, essentially. What it is he wants it so bad, he's so convinced he's worthy, and he's sort of psychically, because he has psychic powers, psychically created his own god, which he's made into his image instead of the other way around, because he's an arrogant prick.
Yeah.
And so that giant Santa Claus head that is him that faces Kirk at the end, which, like, let's face it, feels like a really bad video game villain.
Yes, yes. It reminds me of Altered Beast, like the guy that says, rise from your grave at the beginning, and then you start playing, it's like, this is just weird.
That's totally what it is. But I like the message of, like, okay, Star Trek is about going where no man's gone before. Where has no man gone before left? The final frontier is, of course, the divine.
Fair enough.
That's a very ambitious concept for the writer of Tech War. But the idea was like, if you try to meet the divine, if you try to sort of force your way into controlling the divine, as in like, you're going to see me when I want to see you, not the other way around.
Yeah.
You're only reflecting yourself into this God. And God knows a lot of people do that in real life, sort of create this God that is actually built in their own image instead of the other way around. Like, there are many, many so-called spiritual leaders that do that.
Yes. Again, but you had your point saying I don't think it has a place in sci-fi.
Yeah.
And there's this whole problem about, you know, when you need to go through the great barrier that nobody has ever, you know, passed. And it's like, they don't even mention the problems in passing it. It's like, okay, we'll be there in a couple of hours. And they pass it, no problems. Like, where's the drama here? It was supposed to be this unpassable barrier. And there's no mention of even the ship going through it and having any problems whatsoever. It's like, okay, why didn't people try harder then? It's ridiculous.
No, there's a lot of obstacles set up that are sort of defeated in the most anticlimactic way possible.
Yeah.
Like, Uhura beats some bad guys by dancing in a little skirt thingy. Like,
that's something I never wanted to see, honestly.
It's like, that's William Shatner's really weird fantasies coming into play here, going like, I've worked with this woman for years, and she has never put on a skimpy outfit for me. She will do it now.
Yes. Yeah, okay, that image, okay.
It's like, what is this? But I like the general message. I like the bookends, like the when they sing Row Your Boat with Spock, who goes like, what's the point of singing?
Yeah.
Like, I kind of like those. I think they're super charming. They're very human moments, and they're cute. Like, I'm not blind. I know this movie has problems up the wazoo. Not the least of which is, like, basic continuity. Like, this is the one where they go through the elevator and go through every floor, like, 16 times. Like, 1, 57, 12, 6, 9, 52 again.
Hey, that's how the decks are numbered on Enterprise. Completely random. Okay.
I am going on deck 52, the first one, not the second. from the top or from the bottom? I'm not sure. But I think it has its heart in the right place. I think it has a certain sweetness. Now, granted, I saw it when I was really young.
Yeah.
Where I was just around that age of sort of asking these questions about spirituality and why people behave badly but say that you do it in the name of God, all of that. Like, right around that age when you start asking yourself these questions.
Yeah.
So it hit a button for me where it was like, oh, I get what you're doing. Oh, even, you know, laser gun movies can have messages that actually speak to me on a deeper level. So it worked for me on that level, and I have never revisited it since, because I suspect that how clumsily it's made will suddenly sort of really be apparent.
It's kind of like the first one. You can see where they were going. If that they cut half of that movie, it would have been a great episode. But is it, like you said, very clumsily made. And that's the thing with the fifth one, is just so many things that, you know, is just weird. And, you know, hey, let's have the crew of the starship, you know, make a SWAT mission to rescue hostages. I'm like, that's not what they were trained for. They were trained to man a vessel, not for SWAT action rescue hostages. It's ridiculous. And then the barrier thing, I was like, I'm sorry. You know, I can see, now that I explain, I can see what they're doing, but it's too clumsy. It's way too clumsy.
Yeah, no, I cannot disagree with that. And I think part of my always defending it is because there's such an overt reaction to it. It's like, this is the worst movie in the world. It's so dumb. Everything about it is stupid. And I disagree with that. I think, no, there's a lot of stuff where Shatner had generally something interesting to say. Mm. I think he chose the wrong medium. That is not a Star Trek story.
Yeah.
And B, you know, is not that skilled a storyteller to begin with.
Yeah.
So it has problems, but I don't think it's completely worthless.
It is the better odd number to one to me. It is the better, you know, 1 through 5. 5 is the better one.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Because, well, the other two are unwatchable because they're better made technically,
yeah,
but they're so boring.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, like, you're not bored, because, like, if you're not entertained by all the random action scenes in it that barely make any sense,
yeah,
you're amused to no end by just, like, the numerous continuity errors, the sudden burst of insanity that gets into the plot.
Spock's rocket boots.
Fantastic stuff! And it's the one where the characters feel the warmest, you know, with the row your boat scene, which a lot of people have made fun of, but I actually think it's really sweet.
Yeah, they're camping. They don't have any involved songs to sing, you know, just sing, row your boat, it's fine.
Yeah, no, I think it's sweet. But yeah, it's not a good movie.
No, it's not.
All right, moving on to an actually good movie, because we're back into the even numbers one, and it's my second favorite of the old Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
It's Undiscovered Country.
Yeah.
A political thriller.
Indeed. An accident happens on the Klingon homeworld.
Yeah.
And now they want to make peace. So basically they have Kirk and the Enterprise, because it's the flagship, you know, go there and, you know, talk to the Chancellor. And somebody kills the Chancellor. And basically Kirk and McCoy they're the one that they think that they did it, and they're sent to prison, and they basically have to figure out who actually killed the Chancellor and, you know, save Kirk and McCoy and basically make peace.
Mm. And Kirk's really pissed off because they killed his son.
Yeah, they killed his son, and that's basically one of the things. They basically use his recording saying, you know, he never trusts Klingons. He doesn't trust Klingons. He never will. And they use that in his trials. Like, yo, yeah, you know, tell me you didn't kill him now. You know, you don't trust Klingons. You never liked them. And it's a very good story.
It's a really good story, and what I find really cool is this is the first time they did it, and it never occurred to me that this is the first time that they did it, because Next Generation will do that on a regular basis on the series, but this is the first time they put the Star Trek concept in and mixed it with politics.
Yeah.
And it works really well, because politics is the one arena where that sort of unwavering cry for reason and optimism is sort of like, oh yeah, we need that. We desperately need that.
Yeah, it's basically saying, you know, we might have solved all the problems on Earth and everything, but the other races are not the same. It's basically saying, you know, you and your group of friends might be like all enlightened and fine and, you know, have great ideas about politics. Not everybody thinks your way, so it's not always going to be super easy to have them see your viewpoint and come to an agreement.
And it also sort of flashes like, yeah, we've solved all of these problems, but not completely. You know, Kirk hates Klingon.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, the movie doesn't hide from that. It's racism. It's justified racism in the sense of, like, can you blame a guy for harboring a certain animosity towards a people that killed his son in a political conflict? Of course not. But it is racism.
Yeah, I mean, it's like hitting all Klingons because, you know, one Klingon killed your son. It's you know, it is pretty much, you know, it's racism. It's like hitting, you know, all black people because one black person stole your wallet. It's like, it's a little racist there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we understand where he's coming from, but the movie makes a clear point of like, but he's coming from a bad place that humans are supposed to have evolved beyond.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting thing where it's sort of like, no matter how far you've gone, no matter how enlightened you've become, you got to be in check always.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing. And like the movie presents it as like, no, it's a good thing. It means that you're constantly evolving. When you're presenting yourself with new challenges, it means you're going to fail at some of them. And that's a good thing. That's the human experience.
Exactly.
So on a human level, it's great.
Yeah.
And the plot, like the actual thriller.
Yeah.
It's a good mystery.
I know. Trying to find out how did they shot the Chancellor? Who did it? And where did they hide all the evidence? And, you know, maybe they destroy it. No, they can't destroy it because, and they show, you know, so it's hidden somewhere on the ship. You need to find it. That ship must be huge. And just a search, like, it must be insane. Yeah.
And who played the Klingon? Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
He's so good.
Yeah.
Now, that movie's awesome. Like, that one is one where, you know, I know you've already seen Wrath of Khan and you'll revisit it, but if you haven't thought of revisiting Undiscovered Country, that movie is so freaking awesome.
Yeah.
I have really nothing else to say.
Me neither. Watch the movie. That's all there is. Great ending, too. You know, it's like, you know, okay, it's done. Then business. Back to business as usual. Let's do this.
Yeah. It has everything you want from a Star Trek movie in terms of the message, the sci-fi, the appropriate setting for a sci-fi fan.
Yeah.
And yet, it's completely different from all the rest.
That's true.
you know?
Yeah.
As in, you know, I can't stress that enough. This is certainly one of the better efforts that they've made in a very long series full of duds.
Yes, yes.
On that note, if you have any questions, comments, you want to share with us your love of Kirk or Spock or Bones or boning Kirk and Spock.
Oh, God. You went there.
I did. You can mail us at mail@idiomatic.com or post a comment at idiomatic.com. We're also on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. We're also on iTunes. But don't worry, guys. Frank and Chris and all the bunch will be back soon enough, as soon as we finish this interminable Star Trek thing.
You say interminable, I say awesome.
See you next time, guys. We'll be right back.